Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Joe Zimmel and Valerie Friedman.
Pretty dress up clothes to wear, bright bows, cute hair, are just a part of her story.
Is Kurt Elling and Jimmy Green. I thought I was going to have trouble getting through this whole show without crying. I'm having trouble getting through the first 30 seconds. That's Anna's Way by Jimmy Green. It's about his daughter. I think most people who live around Connecticut know that she was one of the children who murdered at Sandy Hook in 2012. We're going to talk today about grief. And grief is a thing. It's a word we sling it around a lot. But the thing that I didn't quite understand, I thought grief was just being really, really sad. And I, to do this show and tell you why we're doing the show, I'm going to have to tell you a little something about me. If you listen a lot, you probably guessed a little bit of this. But so the two people closest to me, really, my partner of many years, the woman I love and live with, and my son, have both been terribly, terribly sick. My son was diagnosed with a really terrifying illness on July 1st of last year. So we're 11 months into the treatment of this illness. And, you know, the outcome is still something we don't know. But even in the course of the treatment, a lot of things have been lost that really can't be brought back. There have been certainly some days and nights where I thought he might just slip away right then and there. And then November 10th, my significant other, my partner, the woman I love and live with, went in for what we thought was going to be fairly routine heart surgery, if there is such a thing. And she's never come home since then. She's been in a series of hospitalized settings. A whole series of things have gone wrong. And her future is also very uncertain. And a lot of things, I think, are probably not recoverable at this point. So over the course of the last few months, I've had these moments. One night when she called me, a lot of this took place, you know, during COVID. You couldn't go see the person. The hospitals were closed. You know, there were months where I really couldn't even talk to her. She couldn't speak very well because of her illness. But she called me one night because she thought she was going to die that night, not unreasonably. And we did say goodbye that night. Another night, I remember, in terms of my son. And in each case, something kind of burst loose inside me that was grief. And I realized I didn't know prior to that what grief was. It's like this dark animal that just bursts out inside you. That's what it feels like to me anyway. This thing that's inside me, it's like thrashing its dark tentacles around inside me. And I thought, oh, that's grief. I had no idea. I thought I knew what it was. So we're going to talk to somebody else who has a deep acquaintance with this subject, and that is Nelba Marquez Green. She is the mother of Anna. And she is someone who has carried forward the story of what happened in Sandy Hook in 2012. She's the director for community advancement at Central Connecticut State University, a licensed marriage and family therapist, and the founder of the Anna Grace Project. And she's with us now. First of all, Nelba, thank you so much for agreeing to do this.
Thank you for having me.
I guess I want to ask you a question based on what I just said. I mean, prior to December 14th, 2012, did you know what grief was, or were you in the kind of same position? I mean, I lived through the death of my parents. I had some very bad things happen that made me very, very sad. But I don't know. Did you become acquainted, I guess, with kind of a different creature called grief?
Well, first, before we get started, as someone new to your story, I just want to stop and acknowledge that. Thank you for sharing that with me, with us today. I think the only way we can bring awareness to this thing that is grief and this living with grief is if we share our stories. But all too often, we are reluctant to share them.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, we just tend to really focus on recovery or overcoming. And we don't like to talk about that dark, I think you said dark animal or dark night.
Yeah, it feels like an animal. It feels to me like an animal sometimes inside.
Yeah, and everyone experiences it quite differently. I've heard lots of descriptive terms to talk about grief. But one thing is universal, and that is that the person who is experiencing this feeling has had to let go of any perception of normal or how they thought their life would be. That's pretty universal. And that's where that grief comes in. So you, with your experiences that you just shared, me with, you know, sending a child to school and not getting her back and growing a survivor, those are two examples, right? And it can happen very suddenly. You know, mine was very suddenly, or it can happen over time with a prolonged or illness or an experience like that. But no matter how it happens, the universal is it requires a letting go of what we thought our lives would be like. Nobody wakes up in the morning and expects, you know, a tower to come down. Nobody wakes up in the morning and expects that's the day a mass shooting happens in the workplace. Nobody wakes up in the morning when they go to a routine medical appointment and expects to hear, let's run more tests,
mm-hmm.
right? So it is a letting go of what we believed would be our life and a kind of a realization that that's not what will come.
I think we live in a culture of solutions, you know, and so
yes.
so the tower comes down and there's, well, we're going to get those guys who brought the tower down, you know, and that'll fix it. And there's a sense that, you know, if you think about what our culture looks like, the movies and television shows we watch, most of them come to some kind of conclusion or solution. There's this notion that, yes, ultimately there will be a day where this is no longer the case. But that's not, I don't think, how grief works, Nilva.
It isn't how grief works. And also, I want you to notice, between the time we have this conversation and the time that there's a next national tragedy, it's not going to be a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I want you to notice how quickly the shouts of resilience, and I'm not suggesting it comes from a bad place, but it comes from our natural need and inclination to find solutions. So that from the shooting to the time we were exclaiming, Newtown strong, that was probably a matter of hours, mm-hmm. right? And we do that with every tragedy and with every situation because in part of what you said, that we are a community that looks for solutions. And I'm not quite sure that not allowing space for grief and for hurt and for pain and for the existence of those things is solution focused for the griever. Maybe for those people watching for whom our pain is too difficult to bear, a solution for them, but it certainly wasn't the solution for me to hear Newtown strong when I wasn't feeling really strong at all.
Yeah, it's almost like there's no emotional or intellectual market for this, for what we're talking about right now. I think even of, you know, one of the hospitals that's been involved in my family situation, they have this wonderful commercial that, you know, about cancer with people holding up bicycles and singing, everybody wants to be. You've seen this commercial. And it's a very exuberant, promising commercial. And I get why you would do a commercial like that, because you do want to say, look, you know, that we're good at what we do. You know, we're good at what we do and we can help you. But it's hard to imagine how you could ever do the equivalent of that really acknowledged that it is, first of all, okay to be sad, and you're just going to be incredibly sad sometimes about certain things. It's like we haven't really created much space to have that conversation.
We haven't, and I get, like you, the need for those commercials. Without hope, we have very little. So we have to create spaces for hope, but also we need to create spaces for when we are in this deep place. And I find there's one group of people that really does this really well, and that's hospice workers. If you ever sit down and speak with people who are in hospice or end-of-life doulas, they know how to sit with pain. Mm-hmm. They know how to sit with pain so well. And they can actually hold both hope and darkness. And they can hold the importance of witnessing really well, because that's what grief needs. Grief needs accompaniment. And hospice folks do that really, really well. Every once in a while, I meet someone who really gets it. And when I explore, they usually have lost someone too, and really have made that transition from, oh, we got to find a solution to this, to I'm going to bear witness to this.
I want to talk a little bit about faith, because you're a person of faith. And if it's okay with you too, because I just know this song is important to you, we might play in the background Thank You by Richard Smallwood and Vision. So I've kind of come and gone from church, but obviously this is a time, you know, when you're facing grief, an incredible loss, that you turn there. But I don't know, Nell, but for me, it's also a time where I start out thinking, why am I here? You know, what? Why have I been selected? Why have the people that I love been selected for such dire things to happen? And obviously the Bible is full of stories. I know you mentioned Noah and Job. I've found myself thinking a lot about and going back over Job. But I don't know. I mean, it's to me, it's a very double-edged sword. It's a source of comfort, but it's also, I find myself saying, I thought you were going to not let this happen to me. But I guess that's not really what the promise is.
No, it isn't. And it's especially when we've done things. I mean, we're decent human beings, right? We haven't hurt anyone. We try to live our lives in a good way. We you know, in our family, I remember looking at Jimmy and saying, we go to church weekly. We tithe. We give money. We're good people. How could we have found ourselves in this situation? But the promise of faith isn't that bad things won't happen. The promise of faith is that hopefully faith will offer comfort when those bad things do happen. And that's what we have found. I'm really glad that wasn't something, a process we started after, that was kind of a foundation we had before. Because I personally, for our family, and again, I don't go around pushing people into a belief set that they're not ready for or don't have or don't want to have. But I'm personally grateful that we had that, because I don't know how we'd still be standing without. Thursday actually will be the 4,000th day that we have lived after the shooting that took our daughter's life. And I don't think we would have lived 4,000 days without our faith foundation.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I had a night where I kind of walked out in the yard and started talking to God and saying, I mean, not exactly what you just described, but kind of like, geez, I really have tried to take this so seriously, you know, and I mean, one thing that I think that I had to sort of face is, it's not, I don't know, it's not Christ Church of insurance, you know, you're not buying some kind of policy that's going to keep these things away from you. Although I think that was almost the way I was thinking. How come I've been paying my premiums to you? You know, how come this is happening? But then the other thing that I think that you've said that I think is really profound, I'd like you to talk about it a little bit, is somehow or other, I mean, this song is called Thank You, and you still have to be able to somehow or other get to a place where you could say those words, thank you. Maybe you can just sort of reflect on that a little bit.
I will tell you that in the months before we moved back to Connecticut from Winnipeg, Manitoba, our church at the time, White Ridge Baptist Church of Winnipeg, started a study, and it was a study on the Book of Job. And I remember our pastor, Pastor Terry Jank at the time, said, it's my responsibility as a pastor that for when the day of calamity strikes your door, that you would be able to lift your hands like Job and say, I know that my Redeemer lives, and in the end, he will reign upon the earth. And I remember thinking, that's really profound, with no clue or context that on December 14th, 2012, we would make the choice, not be forced to, but make the choice to do the same thing. And I really give a lot of thanks to my husband, Jimmy Green, whose song you played at the beginning, for also sharing that with me. Because one thing is to grieve alone, your individual process of grief. The other thing is to do a process of grief with your significant other. with your partner, with your loved one. Grief is individual. It's also relational. How you grieve in your home with your family also is important and needs to be talked about. And we don't talk about that very much. But yes, to answer your question, we made that choice to raise our hands and say thank you. And I'm incredibly grateful every day for 4,000 days that we have been able to do that thing. Well, today's 3,098. For Thursday will be 4,000.
You obviously, this is the thing you just live with every single day. It's not going to go away. It's not going to change. But of the two of us, your voice is a lot stronger right now. You know, you obviously have found some things that allow you to put one foot in front of the other. And I know they aren't magic wands or anything like that, but maybe you can just say a little bit about what you have done, what has helped.
So it's an evolutionary process. Every day is a different day, and it's not linear. That's really important for your listeners to understand. Other things get better with time. And we are very, very used to living in a culture that promotes that for many different things, right? We're a culture that believes if you work hard enough, you can get over stuff. And grief doesn't necessarily work like that. And it's not just child loss. I would want any of your listeners who, you know, is hearing me right now to understand if you're grieving a loss of parents, if you are grieving, you know, some people contact me and they say, well, my child didn't die like yours. You know, my child overdosed. Or my child died by suicide. This applies to you if you have lost your significant person or thing, or are in the process of struggling with the potential loss of your significant person or thing. You are allowed to grieve. So one of the most helpful things for me was to give myself permission to own every single feeling I had, and to not judge that or evaluate that or give it a ranking of any kind. I just let myself feel. And boy, has that been a gift. Being with other grievers, being with other survivors who can guide through that process. So building a community, right? And no one's going to grieve exactly alike. So it's not like I'm going to meet someone, even if they were in a mass shooting, even if it's another parent from Newtown, and we're going to have the exact same process. We're not. But taking from their stories of survival what works, and leaving behind what doesn't, and allowing spaces of non-judgment for them as well, has been incredibly helpful. So giving myself permission, building community, finding meaningful work, whether that be through volunteerism or creating programs, or, you know, what, you know, I was really fortunate. I was a therapist before, and I still love that work, and I continue to do work in that spirit, although not through direct service. You know, I'm really, really fortunate to have things that are meaningful for me. So finding meaning. And in terms of, like, in your body and with your mind, kind of working through grief and trauma, certainly moving your body, certainly feeding yourself well, nourishing yourself, making sure that you are okay and healthy. I don't know if I talk about this too often, but one of the strangest things that happened to my body after December 14th was that my body actually lost the ability to metabolize iron. So I now regularly have to, and I don't know why, but there's a small percentage of people who experience funny body symptoms after a profound, significant episode, a traumatic episode like the one we had. So making sure you're checking in with your provider, that you are taking steps to keep your mind, body, and spirit well, is really, really important. I find too often survivors want to plow through. Well, I'm just going to get through this. I'm just going to white knuckle it. I'm just going to grit and bear it. I'm just going to pull myself up. In my experience is that's not usually very successful for very long before there is some kind of, I don't want to say breakdown, but there's some kind of negative impact on the mind, body, or spirit.
Yeah, there's actually a book, you may even know it, called The Body Keeps Score.
Yes.
I think the title is Brain, Mind, and Body and the Healing of Trauma. It's one of those books where you should read it, but the title also tells you quite a bit. You know, it's like, oh yeah, I already know my body is keeping score, and not in a good way at all.
Another really great one that I had just the good fortune and opportunity to kind of highlight in some of the work I do for Central and the Anna Grace Project is a new one that's right now a New York Times bestseller. And that's with Oprah Winfrey and Bruce Perry. And it's called What Happened to You? And it's about stories of trauma and resilience. And it's just a really great read. It breaks down both narrative. You get to hear narrative of Oprah's story and maybe guests on her show, and also how it connects to the brain science of what happens to us when we experience significant things. So
I wanted to just talk about one last thing. We could talk for hours about this thing, and this is not a current events conversation we're having right now. But I really have felt from the time that Joe Biden emerged as the clear front runner in the Democratic nomination through the election process that for the first time in a very long time, we have this person who's kind of at the center of our country and the center of our thoughts a lot of times and the center of the destiny of this country, who is uniquely acquainted with grief in a way that very few presidents, I think you could go back to the Kennedy family, obviously, but in a way that very few modern presidents are. And I'm just going to play a little clip. This is him, I think, talking in 2019 to the Des Moines Register.
You know, people would come up after my losses and say, I understand. And, you know, they meant well. Knew they had no idea. How could they? They couldn't have any idea. But when someone would come up and say, I understand, and then tell me, I lost my son, my daughter, my wife, etc., you realize they understand. When you've been through it, what people are really saying to me when they come up and ask me or want me to hug them or just, what they're really saying, tell me I'm going to be okay. Tell me I can get through it. How'd you get through it? It's something that I can't say I enjoy doing, but I know what solace I got from people telling me you can make it, in effect, because they made it. And so that's why I do it. People come up to me and say, I mean, literally, people will say, I don't know if you ever talked to me, they'll say, I lost my daughter 10 days ago. Would you just hug me? Men, just hug me. Let me know. Can I make it? And the extent that it gives any solace, I feel like I'm kind of paying back what people did for me.
No, but there's just a way in which, you know, you can like his policies, you can dislike his policies, you can argue about things, but you can't argue about that, really, that there's a way in which he is in touch with a set of realities that go beyond emotional realities. You know, it really does get back to this thing that we can barely find a name for that we call grief, that I think it's very meaningful to have a president who, you know, just inarguably is in touch with that.
Joe Biden was one of the only people we met in Washington, D.C., who I clearly remember saying, you need to go home. We care about you. We are so sorry for what happened to you, but go home. Take care of your family. Love each other. Get rest, because this is going to be a long, hard fight. So if you're going to do anything for me, I would want you to go home. And I look back at that. I think I was probably maybe incensed at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, we had a job to do in DC. We were going to, you know, change gun laws, change mental health laws. But looking back 3,000 and some odd days later from when we first met Joe Biden, that was wise counsel. Mm-hmm. The care of and feeding of a griever is incredibly important for our long-term health and long-term output. My son is 17 now. He was 8 at the shooting. And I'm incredibly grateful for some of the decisions that Jimmy and I made to put our health and our well-being first, in addition to our activism and our work. But I do think, and I don't want to count my chickens before they're fully hatched, and I know Isaiah will, like any other teenager, have his struggles. But man, this kid is an honor roll student. He plays hockey. He goes to boarding school. He's got good humor. He's got good love around him, and he's able to love. And I know one of the reasons that he's so successful is because Jimmy and I committed to caring for ourselves. You know, we put some goals out there. We worked very hard to not be divorced, right? Grief and child loss kills marriages. We worked very hard to stay healthy and still have joy. So I give a lot of credit to Joe Biden. Yes, I think he is uniquely positioned to guide us in this time. regardless of what you think of his policies. And I remember clearly when he told us to go home.
Well, we're going to stop there, Nelba Marquez Green. But first of all, thank you for everything you said to me today. I mean, I'm sure a lot of listeners got a lot out of it, but I definitely did too. So thank you for sharing. Thank you for some real wisdom about this too. Thanks for just taking the time and the emotional energy to talk about this yet another time.
You shared really bravely today, and I just want to hang in there in that moment with you and say, yeah, you're going to make it. It sucks. Yes, you will make it. And I'm just incredibly thankful to you for being brave and having this vulnerable conversation today, and for the people who will be gifted by this because of your brave sharing, who may also be able to open up after this moment. So thank you.
All right. Well, we're going to go out with, as we went in, we're going to go out with the song Little Voices, as performed by Jimmy Green, with vocals by Hartford's amazing Annika Noni Rose, on Jimmy Green's album, Beautiful Life.
Little voices calling, little voices laughing, little voices singing, all those precious little voices, brightening our day, stealing our hearts, shaping our lives. In the blink of an eye, they're gone. Now there's just silence where those little voices used to be. Now it's up to you. It's up to me. Will you make the choice to be a voice? Will you walk humbly, show mercy, and love your neighbor? Will you love your neighbor? Not fear the neighbor who looks different than you, or hurt the neighbor who thinks differently than you.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. The FDA has recently approved Zepbound, a new medication for chronic weight management. Dr. Davita Umashankar, Hartford HealthCare's System Medical Director of Medical Weight Loss, tells us more.
Zepbound helps decrease hunger and increase satiety levels. Taking this medication for 72 weeks, people can see at the highest dosage approximately 48 pounds of weight loss. So definitely a powerful drug and another powerful tool that we have to utilize to help individuals who struggle with obesity.
For those ready to explore their medical weight loss options, Dr. Umashankar has advice on the first most important step.
I don't think anyone knows you better than your own primary care physician. So having that conversation whenever you feel ready is so important, because these medications are quite powerful and do need to be monitored on a regular basis.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
Join Connecticut Public and Fairfield County's Community Foundation for the In Community Speaker Series, May 2nd, featuring New York Times Magazine journalist Nicole Hannah Jones, creator of the 1619 Project. Jones will talk about her work covering racial injustice and the legacy of slavery on our culture, our politics, and our institutions. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. at District Music Hall in Norwalk. Tickets at ctpublic.org/speaker-series.
All right, we're back. And I want to say that that was recorded a few days ago. So I hope I'm a little bit more composed right now, although I'm not making any promises after that. But if you're listening on Monday the 14th between 1 and 2, we're now live to talk to our second guest, Megan Devine, a psychotherapist, writer, and grief advocate. She's the founder of Refuge in Grief and the author of It's Okay That You're Not Okay, Meeting Grief and Loss in a Culture That Doesn't Understand. And then most recently, How to Carry What Can't Be Fixed, which is a kind of a workbook about the ideas in the prior book. I just want to say, even before we start talking I'm like the last person you give a workbook to. I'm just sort of not like the guy who's going to be able to draw a picture of how he feels on this page or write something inside a circle or outside a circle. But I'm like really addicted to this book. It's like I can't stop messing around with it. This is the workbook for people who hate workbooks. So I don't know, Megan, whether that's a good blurb or not, but it's really an incredibly effective book. Welcome to our show.
Why, thank you. And I love that blurb for my book. I think that's perfect.
So let's talk about, you know, how you've come at this subject. We should just say, obviously, you've got, as they say, skin in the game in this subject. The reason that you're writing about it, advocating about it, is because you've been through it, right?
Correct. Yes. So I've been a psychotherapist for, 20 years or so now. And I did some pretty heavy work in my practice. But my partner died in an accident in 2009. And the grief that unspooled from that was orders of magnitude bigger than anything I'd experienced before that. So yeah, I mean, I like how you phrase that. I have skin in this game. It's important to me.
And even just your voice there as you talked about it makes it clear something that you say, which is loss gets integrated, not overcome. I mean, this isn't a thing that you overcome and get over and then you go on with your life and you still don't gasp at the remembrance of it. I mean, it's still there with you, obviously.
Obviously, yeah. And this is sort of a misnomer, a misidentification or a miseducation or something in the culture, that this idea that if you do grief, quote unquote, correctly, it won't bother you anymore. There is never going to be a time when I'm okay with the fact that my partner died in an accident in front of me. It's never going to be okay that Nelba's child and a bunch of other people were killed in an act of violence. Like, there's, your person stays dead. So you will grieve in some form, in some way, as long as you love that person, which means a lifetime.
I think it really sort of gets at a really almost ontological anxiety that we have too, which is the notion of the stability of self. You know, that most of the time, one of the ways that we sort of proceed through life is, okay, this happened, that happened, this happened. I'm still me, you know, but this happened and that happened. Okay, this other thing just happened, but I'm still me. And then when you get to this, I think there's this whole other dialogue, inner dialogue you have, right? That, am I still me? Am I, like, you know, maybe you could say a little bit about that.
Sure. I think with losses that sort of rearrange your personal universe. Now, I'm not going to define what those losses are because that's a very individual, personal thing. But losses that sort of rearrange your understanding of the world and the way things work, your relationship to other people, to the world, and to yourself, they're going to change. And that sort of deep questioning, am I still the person I was? Is there a bridge between the person before and this person after? That is like personal inquiry that I think more people would benefit from exploring, because I think questioning, am I still that person? Can I still be that person? Is a question that a lot of people carry. And I think it's okay to normalize that self-inquiry.
You know, there's as you suggest in your writing, part of the problem here is we haven't really created good spaces in our social interactions, in life as we live it, for the expression of grief, the discussion of grief, right? It's something people would maybe just as soon not get into.
Yeah, I think it's something that you think we've sort of solved already, like all of our movies, all of our books, all of our pop psychology. They're like, do these 3 steps, 5 steps, do grief correctly, and you'll get your happy ending. And that lie, that misinformation has made a lot of us who want to be supportive to the people we care about, it's sort of given us the wrong narrative. It's given us faulty tools. So when we look at somebody we care about who's struggling or wrestling with grief of any kind, we think, okay, cool, I need to help you be resilient and bounce back and put this loss behind you. Like, we've been sold a faulty narrative, and we're trying to be supportive based on bad information. And in one of the things that I say a lot is, like, it's not our fault that we haven't created skillful ways to respond to grief. we've been taught the wrong ways to do that. It is our responsibility, however, once we know that those old ways are not helping, to learn better skills and better ways of supporting ourselves and supporting the people we care about when grief upends your life.
You know, your books are full of sort of cautionary words about just things that aren't helpful to say, things that people kind of naturally say. I have to say, in my own experience, I've probably committed more of those errors than I've than I've had them committed against me. For the most part, the people around me have been pretty subtle and pretty sensitive and smart and things like that. I'm sure I've done some of the dumb stuff that's in the book, but it's, you know, it is maybe dumb stuff. Maybe that's the wrong way to characterize it, because it's also people. This is what they know. This is how they know to be helpful. They're not trying to be jerks. This is what they've been given in their toolbox.
Yeah, I think there's a small percentage of people who are trying to be jerks and they're honing that skill. But for the most part, people really do think that what they're doing is helpful. You know, most people don't have nefarious intent. And you're right. Like, I mean, I do this stuff for a living and I say stupid stuff, right? I think the thing that's changed for me, hopefully, is that I hear it when I say it, and I'm comfortable enough with being awkward that I'll say, wow, that was really not helpful. I'm going to start over.
I mean, do you want to maybe mention specifically one or two things, just people kind of get the idea? Yeah.
Yeah. So let's say that you're texting with your best friend and they come back with like, I can't actually talk right now. Like my sister just died. Mm-hmm. And so as the support person, you're like, oh shoot, like, what am I supposed to do? And you feel really awkward and really helpless. So you say something like, well, at least they had a really good life. Like, I bet they're at peace now. Mm-hmm. Right. What we're trying to do is remove somebody's pain for them. And we can't do that. Mm-hmm. We do all of this stuff to remove the person's pain for them. Things we say like, think of the happy times, you have to live for them, they wouldn't want you to be sad. All of these things we say, they kind of have a ghost sentence attached to them, mm-hmm. which is, so stop feeling so sad. So stop being upset by this. Right? There's a subtext there that even though we don't say it out loud, is very, very clear to your grieving person. My emotional response to this loss is too hard for you and you'd like me to clean it up now. Right?
Yeah. I think another thing that you've really illustrated very helpfully to me is there's a way in which we think of grief. We kind of put it in one canister. Grief is an emotional state, and it's a specific kind of emotional state. And what you, I think, illustrate in your books is, no, it's a welter of different manifestations ranging from, yes, emotions like anxiety, which we don't, or in anger, two things that we don't necessarily link to grief, and to, per my conversation with Nelba a few minutes ago, really, you know, powerful somatic expressions of this. I mean, people, I don't know, I had a friend who was like immunosuppressed, you know, for a really long time after the loss of a spouse. I mean, maybe say a little something about these physical manifestations.
Yeah. And again, we go back to sort of what is the entertainment narrative around grief? And it's somebody is sad and they're only sad, or they're kind of angry in an ugly way, until they decide to live again, and then they're happy. So we've got this idea that happy is the same as health, right? And anything that's not happy is a problem. So there's one piece. The other thing is, because when many people talk about their experience of grief, they get those platitudes, or they get those, maybe you should talk to somebody, so much so that we're not really hearing real stories of grief out there in the world. And this is why I talk about the realities of grief so much, is because I want people to know that grief is normal. It's uncomfortable. It's messy. It's complicated. It's complex. It's all of these things, but it's normal. And it's not a sign that you're doing anything wrong. And the other reason that I talk about sort of the different aspects of grief is to sort of broaden our idea of what grief is. It's being sad, sure. A lot of people cry. A lot of people don't cry, and that's also okay. You might get angry. You might be confused. The physical effects of grief are something that we really don't talk about very often, and those things can really add a layer of stress or confusion to somebody who's grieving, because they're like, why can't I read anything anymore? My attention span is terrible. So reading comprehension can be effective. You can have cognitive changes, memory changes. For a lot of people, they get very forgetful, right? Like I remember when Matt first died, I had to put post-it notes everywhere to remind me if I had fed the dog that day, because I couldn't remember anymore what had happened even an hour previous. So there are a whole host of things that are within the sphere of normal, honestly, healthy responses to loss that we really do need to start talking about so that people don't think they're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
I loved what Nelva, I just want to put one more thing in here. I really loved what Nelva said towards the end there of like, check these things out with your healthcare providers. Just because physical responses to grief are normal doesn't mean we don't want to have somebody else's eyes on it so we can make sure that your body is supported in the ways that it needs to be while you are going through this.
That's a really great point. No, I was just going to affirm that you are not the only person who puts post-it notes up, like, you know, on the kitchen cabinets saying really basic kinds of things. You might even be talking to somebody who was almost late to tape a little part of this show because you had to go back to the house like four times to get things. So, yes, that's, I think the confusion and disorientation is very much a part of all this. Either that or I need to see a neurologist, too. All right. So let's take a little break here. We're going to be back. By the way, the thing about reading is also really true. And that's the great thing about the workbook, How to Carry What Can't Be Fixed, is, you know, it's not, there's not as much reading and you get to draw pictures and stuff like that, that I think you might feel a little bit more cognitively able to do than, say, read 40 pages at a clip. Anyway, let's take a break. Let's come back with more Megan after this.
It's okay to be sad. It's all right to be lonely. You won't always feel bad.
All right, time to see some thank yous. Kat Pastor is technical producer of this show, and always the technical producer of this show, and that's the way we like it. And this really is Betsy Kaplan's last show as senior producer. I mean, unless she comes back, she may come back someday. She may be the prodigal producer who comes back. In which case, we will serve the fatted calf to her, or whatever we're supposed to do in that parable. But anyway, she is producing this show, even though theoretically, she's off. She's done. You know, this is the most Betsy Kaplan thing in the world to do, is to produce one more show kind of after you've already kind of left. Anyway, but obviously also the perfect person to be producing this show. All right. So onward. Megan Devine is with us, psychotherapist, writer, grief advocate. Her books include It's Okay That You're Not Okay, Meeting Grief and Loss in a Culture That Doesn't Understand, and more recently, the very helpful workbook. It's more than just a workbook, but anyway, How to Carry What Can't Be Fixed. So, you know, yeah, we're going to have to just jump ahead. There's like hours and hours to talk about. And I mean, I think we've already established that you can't fix yourself exactly, but you don't have to stay right where you are either at the time, at your worst moments, in your worst abyss. So can we talk a little bit about sort of what there is in the toolbox to go forward?
Yeah, I really like the distinction between pain and suffering. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, I think we have this, there are binaries all over human culture, and binaries don't work with humans. But this idea that we have that you're either all healed up from your grief, or you're sitting in a basement somewhere wearing sackcloth and sobbing into your skirt, right? Like you either do it all correctly and put it behind you, or you're doing it wrong. And that doesn't work. There's a whole vast middle ground in there. And once we stop talking about grief as a problem to be solved, we can start talking about what tools actually help you survive, what is here for you to survive. And that's where I talk about that difference between pain and suffering, right? So the pain of grief itself is not something we can make go away. Pain needs to get tended, right? So those are things like, what do you do to help yourself in those really big grief spikes or those really difficult moments? How do you tend to the organism? Are you eating, drinking, sleeping, moving your body in the ways that you're able, right? All of those things that help you be strong enough to withstand what you have to withstand. So that's one set of tools. Talking about suffering. So suffering is like all of the extra added stuff that gets lumped on top of your grief. So dealing with the administrative duties of death, right? Calling customer service to have your kid's cell phone cut off is a really horrible thing to go through when your child has died. Anxiety is really big inside grief, right? Especially when loss is sudden, not always with that or not only with that, but I find especially when the loss is sort of unexpected, that can make the whole world feel very unsafe, and that can set people's anxiety off, right? Like, who's going to be next? Mm-hmm. Right. So dealing with things like anxiety, what tools do we have to help ourselves calm down when you can no longer do things like, you know, some of the classic tools inside anxiety work are like reminding yourself that you're safe, that these bad things you imagine are unlikely to happen. When an unlikely event has already happened to you, you can't use those tools anymore. You can't calm your brain down by saying this stuff is unlikely to happen when it already has. So we have to start looking at how do we use tools to help decrease the suffering inside of grief, like anxiety and weird or uncomfortable interpersonal situations. How do we deal with things like interrupted sleep, intrusive thoughts? All of these things that make surviving the reality of loss even harder. That really is where we have tools and skills. If we don't use tools to eradicate the emotions of grief, but instead we use the tools to support the process of grief, I think we have a much better chance of caring for ourselves well and caring for each other well.
There's actually a line in your book that just I made it my thought for the day today. I think you say you're paraphrasing Eckhart Tolle, but it's something along the lines of anxiety is your imagination inventing a future that you don't want. So let's not do that. And boy, you know that's gonna up on my mental wall today. It's such a great idea.
Isn't that a great one? It's so good. And this is the thing, like. Anxiety is a very bad predictor of outcome, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our brains are designed. They create disaster scenarios so that like the brain creating disaster scenarios is like a way to protect the organism. Like, what would you do if this happened? Okay, then what would you do if this happened, right? That's sort of part of the brain's mechanism is to explore disaster as a way to protect the organism, but that doesn't help you. Like, you're never going to run out of disaster scenarios. So instead, it's like this conscious practice, this conscious effort of saying, I'm going to vote for the reality or the outcome that I most want. And if I'm having a hard time imagining that reality, or just to be blunt about it, sometimes there is no quote unquote good outcome. Let's turn our minds to best possible outcome, or I'm going to imagine to marshal the visual aspects of my brain to say, like, what would a beautiful or well-supported or well-skilled or something outcome look like for me, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't battle disaster scenarios in your brain. You can't do it. It won't work. But let's vote for the best possible outcome given what is yours to live.
Yeah, Ibsen said to live is to battle with trolls in the vaults of heart and brain. But you don't want to be in an Ibsen play.
No, I really don't.
And I do think also, yeah, I think another, we're almost out of time here, unfortunately, but we really, but there is a way in which you just have to kind of recalibrate your baseline too, you know? I mean, you're not at the old baseline. You got to pick a new one.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you've never had to live through this loss before. Even if you've lived through multiple losses, you have never lived through this one. We don't know who you're going to be. We don't know how you're going to carry it, mm-hmm. right? So acknowledging that to yourself and being curious about who you are, what you might need, what does a beautiful life look like for you as you live this? We don't know the answer to that, but I think being curious about that answer is a really good way forward.
Some of us who are going through this together, we have a slogan, which we stole from Friday Night Lights. It's clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose. And it doesn't mean you can't lose in the sense that, you know, the outcome will be exactly what you want. But you can't lose. I think if you put yourself in a certain kind of frame of mind about all this, you know, you'll be able to salvage some certain kinds of victories long term. So that's like what we say. You know, we're going to have to stop. And I regret that because there's so much more to say. But for that reason, if you're facing this, or I mean, everybody's going to face some version of it someday. So the book is It's Okay That You're Not Okay, Meeting Grief and Loss in a Culture That Doesn't Understand. And if you're already in the middle of things and you're finding it really hard, I would recommend the other one, How to Carry What Can't Be Fixed, A Journal for Grief. This is something that allows you to write and draw and explore your own feelings and maybe create strategies for getting through the days. Thanks to Megan. Thanks to Nelba. Thanks to Betsy Kaplan and Kat. Thanks to you for listening, too. I know this is a little raw compared to what we usually do, but it was a show I really thought we had to do.